If everything works out correctly, this podcast will have come out on January 9th, 2024, my 33rd birthday. Also, if the background sounds a bit weird, that's because I'm outside and recording parts of today's show at San Diego's newest park, the River Park at San Diego State University, Mission Valley. So on that note, hi, I'm Joel Garcia, and welcome to the Season 5 premiere of the Pop Culture Shuffle. On today's season premiere, I have a few things to talk about. First up, I highlight my favorite classic TV sitcom. Then, I'll give my first impressions of the River Park. Plus, I have some fan fiction to highlight in an old segment from all the way back in 2023. And finally, since we're nearby where a certain stadium used to be, my thoughts on the Chargers' failure of a season. But first, let's go indoors to talk TV. In past season premieres, I've discussed my favorite films and anime. Originally, I was going to discuss one that would combine both topics, but I chose to keep gestating that concept for a while. Instead, I wanted to highlight my favorite classic TV sitcom. Being a 90s kid, one would assume that my favorite would be something popular at the time, like Friends or Seinfeld. Maybe an obscure show like Just Shoot Me or Third Rock from the Sun. Yeah, I watched a lot of NBC. Actually, it would be one from the 1970s. The Brady Bunch. For those unaware, The Brady Bunch pretty much sums up its premise in its memorable theme song. It's a story about a man named Mike Brady with three boys of his own, Greg, Peter, and Bobby, who one day meets this lady, Carol, who also has three girls of her own, Marsha, Jan, and Cindy. They get together and form a family, hence The Brady Bunch. From 1969 to 1974, through five seasons on ABC, the family, as well as their maid Alice, dealt with a wide range of shenanigans, from getting hit in the nose by a football to being cursed by a tiki. Also, the dreaded evil simply known as Cousin Oliver. The sitcom was created by Sherwood Schwartz, who previously created the similarly classic TV show Gilligan's Island. In a 1997 interview he gave to the Television Academy, aka the organization behind the Emmys, he said he was inspired to create the series by a 1965 news report which indicated a third of marriages at the time included a child from a past marriage. The show obviously aired long before my time. Like many 90s kids, I discovered it by watching Nick at Night, Nickelodeon's long-running evening block that has predominantly aired classic sitcoms. Nowadays, it mostly tends to be Friends and Mom, but back then they tend to air much older series, such as I Love Lucy and The Brady Bunch. The sitcom naturally stood out to me from the other types of shows I would watch at the time. It was quite possibly the oldest one I had ever seen, which beforehand might have been DuckTales, as in the original one from the 80s, not the 2017 reboot. It felt very clean-cut, as it wasn't as cheesy as that 70s show, or as silly as Friends, or as crass as Just Shoot Me. The show had this fun and innocent charm with the kids' wacky adventures, the wild trips the family would go on, and Alice being overall quirky. Its biggest indicator that it was a product of the late 60s and early 70s were in the form of guest appearances by Davy Jones, Joe Namath, and Dodgers legend Don Drysdale. There was just something comforting about a show where the family's biggest issues were relatively small scale, such as smoking, puberty, and lawsuits. If I had to bring up some of my favorite episodes, the first would be Season 2's When There's Smoke. It's a very special episode about Greg smoking, and well, the consequences of lying, or not lying. It originally premiered on January 8, 1971, only a week after the last cigarette commercial ever aired on TV, showing how times were already changing when it came to people's thoughts on smoking. Another episode I really enjoy is Season 4's Bobby's Hero, which is about Bobby becoming a fan of outlaw Jesse James, much to the shock and confusion of his parents. The episode has a timeless message for those who find out their loved ones are fans of really terrible people, one that could be taken for, say, someone in the past or someone today. Also, there's that infamous scene where Bobby sees Jesse James gun down his whole family right in front of him. I should note the show was overall lighthearted, but knew when to get serious with a sense of humor. I also liked watching The Brady Bunch due to my general enjoyment of films and shows with big families. That concept proudly defies the cliché nuclear family, which normally consists of two parents, two or three kids, and the optional pet. There are several examples I can come up with that have explored the concept in some form or another. You have obvious examples such as Cheaper by the Dozen and The Loud House, which take the nuclear family but quintuple the number of kids. Alternatively, others like Coco, Encanto, and the Casagrandes have multi-generational families, which include grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins, all living under one roof. The Brady Bunch used a third tactic, one that at the time was something new for TV. Widowers, each with children of their own, forming a new family. Shows with widowers were nothing new at the time. Earlier in the same decade, My Three Sons began airing on CBS, and that show was about a widower with, well, three sons. If that sounds boring, it lasted 12 seasons. If there were any flaws with the sitcom, it would be how the combined family quickly accept their new arrangement. That is mostly due to the series starting at the wedding, meaning we don't get to see how both sides deal with the loss of their respective partner slash parent and how they ultimately got together. The former is only briefly acknowledged in the first episode, while the latter is quickly summed up in the aforementioned theme song. Also, the episodes with Cousin Oliver were not very good. It felt like the show didn't know what to do with the kids getting older and instead had to add a new kid to retain their younger fans. I could bring up the era this show aired in, especially considering the show was on at the same time as both the Vietnam War and Watergate. However, if you were to watch any random episode, neither of those events or any other zeitgeist of the time are explicitly brought up. At no point will you ever see Greg think about the draft or Cindy ask her parents if President Nixon is a crook. Modern day interviews by those who worked on the show seem to indicate that the goal was to intentionally avoid that. In a 2019 retrospective for the Television Academy, in the article Brady Mania, producer Lloyd J. Schwartz, Sherwood's son, said the show solely focused on the Brady kids and not what was happening elsewhere. Peter Brady himself, Christopher Knight, reinforced that statement by saying, even as the Vietnam War reached its peak, the show was still about the family and their home. With that said, the lack of current events served to make the show relatively timeless. It is still obviously set in that specific era, such as one episode relying on the punchline of a payphone, but avoids risking becoming even more outdated by acknowledging something that may become controversial at a later date. If you want a good example, it's like how you see a bunch of 80s sitcom constantly reference Bill Cosby. Certain modern sitcoms and even animated series follow a similar concept. They may acknowledge their respective decades, but avoid bringing up details such as who is the current president. I can't recall a single episode of The Big Bang Theory or The Loud House in which they say, oh yeah, the president's name is Bringing it back to the Bradys, the show has continued to thrive to this day through a variety of formats. In addition to airing in syndication on both TV and streaming, there have been TV movie follow-ups, a short-lived Saturday morning cartoon, a goofy variety show, a sequel sitcom about Jan and Marsha, and even a drama with most of the same cast. I've only seen bits and pieces of these subsequent productions, most especially A Barry Brady Christmas. That TV movie felt like it was trying to be a bit more dramatic by the lack of a laugh track, And by having the characters all, oh, we're all struggling with our own personal conflicts, but we're all gonna work together and have a happy Christmas. As for the aforementioned drama, let's just say The Brady's is a unique piece of television that turned a family sitcom into a corny melodrama. The only other thing I can say about these shows is that I've seen an episode of The Brady Kids and it is very bizarre. Especially by the fact that the kids are now suddenly hanging out with a magical talking bird, two pandas, and well, it just gets weirder from there, and I haven't even brought up the fact that at one point they meet the Lone Ranger and Wonder Woman. As for the two 90s film adaptations, the Brady Bunch movie and a Barry Brady sequel, that is a story for another day, but I will say for now that the Brady Bunch movie is how it was introduced to everyone's favorite Drag Race host, RuPaul. The Brady Bunch is a great classic sitcom that I would highly recommend checking out. Except for season 5. The show is available to own on DVD and stream on Paramount Plus. And we're back outside, and I'm here to tell you my thoughts on San Diego's newest park, the River Park. Now, for most people who didn't grow up here in San Diego, or just simply never had the opportunity to pass by the stadium, most of what is the park now used to be parking. And I do mean excessive parking. It was the kind of parking that was behind the trolley, where normally you'd see, oh, some parking, and if there was some event that didn't require a bunch of seating, excess seating on the corner. And I can still recall those days where I would pass by where Qualcomm was doing something random, and they had all the football seating right outside. Just tossed aside like it was nothing. And I also recall for the longest time, in the corner of this park, there used to be this tiny baseball field, where, unless I'm wrong, they used to do some Little League baseball, and then at some point it became something about Brazilian soccer training. And I think I recall at one point it used to be like a tiny training area for the San Diego Fleet before, well, that whole league shut down. Remember the Alliance of American Football? When it comes to this park, it's actually pretty good. It's pretty beautiful. It's amazing what they've done with the place. It's just another phase of construction here at San Diego State University's Mission Valley expansion, which so far has consisted of the stadium, which in fact I'm looking right at it, Snapdragon Stadium, and just the park. And everything about it looks visually impressive. You have this wide expansive field that I'm sitting right next to on one of these pretty good wooden benches. There are basketball courts, there's a bunch of picnic area, and some relatively decent greens. I say decent because I'm looking at this field right now, and most of it is dead. Like, it's very brown. To be fair, it's January, since, well, not much can grow in January, and I should know. My old high school used to have this field that, when the semester began, it used to be green, but by the end of the school year, it was dead brown. Just straight up dead brown. I can't recall a single year in which it just suddenly turned green again before, oh no, school's over and the grass is dead. Because they played so many games on that field. Just dead grass everywhere. Now, for the most part, this park is impressive. And admittedly, the issue comes down to the fact of where you enjoy the noise. Because every once in a while, the trolley will come by. Because every 15 to 20 minutes, you hear the trolley come and go, come and go. Even though this is a relatively huge expansive space, it's still stuck in between the highway, well, two highways, the stadium, but also, well, Fenton Parkway, which I can see from my point of view, the IKEA. Now, none of that makes this a terrible park. No, 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 no. This is still a beautiful park. And I do like the fact that San Diego has finally got another park, since I always felt like we have Balboa Park and that's about it. Like, we have Balboa Park and a bunch of other tinier parks that, well, I'm not going to say they're bad, it's just that, like, they're really cramped. They're tiny, they're compact, and there's not much room to, well, have fun. Not to say that you can't have fun in a tiny park, I'm just saying that, like, I haven't seen any other park as big as this one. The river park here is impressively big. Like, I'm just looking here at a distance and I can see, like, at least like a mile away or 2 miles away. It just goes on and on. And I'm just looking at it from one side. The other side has this spot for, well, any floodwaters. Because here in this space, there used to be a lot of problems with flooding. I can recall back in 2010 when a massive rainstorm came by and it flooded Qualcomm. But thankfully, that place has so many holes and craters, it just still went out of the stadium and flooded everywhere else. This is still pretty beautiful. It's a pretty good spot for just to have fun, to sit back, relax, and enjoy the sights. Well, if you can enjoy the trolley sound, the sounds of the trolley, but other than that, it's pretty good, and I'm eager to see what SDSU does next with the spot, because I know that they're going to build more. What's currently the parking lot for Snapdragon will eventually become more buildings, housing, and at some point they're going to build some more educational facilities here. If I recall correctly, I think it was for biology. And at some point there might be a hotel, so that somewhat open-air view of Snapdragon might be a bit obscured by a hotel. But for the most part, it's pretty expansive. And just another indicator of how expansive River Park is, from where I'm sitting, I can see some of the seats from Snapdragon and even one of the screens. It's that big. So is there anything else I can say about River Park that doesn't sound like I'm just boasting about my alma mater's park? Probably not. But then again, it is impressive how this place went from being a parking lot to, well, ironically, paradise. It's like that terrible train song, which they say, oh, they're paving up paradise but a parking lot. Here it's backwards. They took out the pavement and built paradise, in a way. So, that's pretty much all to say about River Park. It's beautiful, it's expansive, it's great, and a decent spot for a podcast, if you can ignore the sounds of the traffic and the trolley, which, thankfully, during most of this recording, has been relatively low-key. The River Park is a beautiful spot to just have fun and explore, and I highly implore anyone to check it out. The following segment was originally recorded back in March of 2023. It is the last of the segments I worked on during my hiatus. It is relatively evergreen, save for a dig I made towards a certain film that had come out at the time. Enjoy.
You know, despite the fact that Harry Potter has become a very controversial topic to talk about, whether you're talking about the controversial author or just the story in of itself, there's something I think people tend to overlook. Now, I'm not talking about Ron as a Death Eater, or how, oh, why is he with Hermione? No, not that. If there's one thing I've noticed with a lot of fanfic, especially for Harry Potter, is how they really don't like the fact that Harry is with the Dursleys. As in, the aunt and uncle that he was stuck with for 10 years until the wizards came back and said, oh, by the way, you're a wizard, let's go. And it's something I've noticed that happens to a very disturbing extent, to the point where several stories just simply have a wizard come by and say, you know what, you guys suck, let's roll, before it even goes to Hogwarts. I could go on and bring up so many bad examples of stories in which they just do this and don't care about explaining anything, like how, oh, Harry's descended from Merlin, or how he's also an Amazon king, because that makes sense. And there's this one story I found online about Sailor Pluto adopting Harry because... yeah. I can make a whole show just highlighting these fanfictions, but they all follow the same pattern, in which Harry lives a miserable life, some character from another franchise shows up, adopts him, the end. There's more of that, of course, but for the most part, right after the adoption part, it just goes into whatever franchise the original character's from. Which leads me to talk about this particular crossover fanfic, titled Just a Fact by Elemental Elf. It's a crossover between Harry Potter and the anime manga series Soul Eater. Just to briefly talk about Soul Eater, Soul Eater is a story set at the Death Weapon Meister Academy, also known as the DWMA, which is about three different groups of characters, in which the unique quirk about the show is how essentially it's like a buddy cop series, in which there's one character who acts as a Meister, and then there's the weapon. And by that I mean, this character can turn into a weapon. So in particular, you got a character like Maka Albarn, who is a Meister. And then her partner is a guy named Soul Eater Evans, who can turn into a Psy. There are of course more examples, such as the character of Des the Kid, who can wield two guns, who are also people known as Patricia and Elizabeth Thompson, and so on and so forth. And if you're wondering, no, Des the Kid is not the Grim Reaper. That would be his dad, who is mostly also known as Shinigami, aka Lord Death. I've only seen the anime, and while the first few episodes are pretty good and funny, it manages to fall apart halfway through, some story arcs go on for too long, the bad guy stops being interesting halfway through, and then the second bad guy is very forgettable, and to the point where I just was wondering when this story would end, and the finale itself was very underwhelming. Almost like there were supposed to be more adventures, but nobody cared to continue it. And as for his spinoff, Soul Eater Not, well, I hate everything about it. The characters were annoying, the animation style was atrocious, and it spent too much time setting things up, and by the time it reaches its finale, you're wondering, okay, what's next, and then the story ends. With that said, let's get to the story, and I'm gonna go with the summary this time around because, well, I pretty much spoiled what the story will be about. The synopsis reads, Harry Potter never went to Hogwarts. His relatives refused to send him. They moved to Dead City when Harry was 17. They were going to have their son become a great mister. Lord Death figures out that Harry was abused and removed him from that home. Can Harry live a happy life or will Dumbledore get him? Multi-weapon slash half-witch Harry. Now, I should note that in that synopsis, Meister is misspelled as Mister, and Dead City is the main location of the DWMA. So with all that said, let's get to the first chapter, which has no title. Here is chapter 1 of Just a Fact by Elemental Elf. Harry Potter was a strange boy. He was both a weapon and half-witch. As a weapon, he could change into many different ones, and so far hasn't found one that he couldn't change into. He was an orphan who was forced to live with his abusive aunt, uncle, and cousin. Currently, Harry and his relatives were on their way to Lord Death's office. Dudley was going to be a Meister at askew. Harry was going to be his weapon even though their souls were incompatible, and therefore Dudley couldn't even hold Harry, let alone wield him. Harry was, of course, the one who was punished when Dudley couldn't hold him. Listen here, freak, his uncle began as they drew closer to his office. You better not embarrass us, nor any freakiness, or else I'll make you beg for death. Harry swallowed before answering. Yes, sir. They stopped at the door and knocked. A few seconds later, the door opens on what looks like its own. They entered and began walking down yet another hall. It wasn't long until another door blocked their path, and after knocking the door open, it revealed a large room with a gigantic mirror in the middle and a black shape in front. The shape turned as they walked in, and Harry saw the skull mask. Harry had to hide a giggle. The mask was comical, especially with its large gloved hands.
Hello, I am Lord Death.
He waved his hands, causing Harry to hide another giggle, while the Dursleys had a hard time hiding their disgust.
Good morning, Lord Death. I am Vernon Dursley. This is my wife Petunia, and my son Dudley, he said proudly.
Oh, and this is my wife's nephew and my son's weapon, Harry Potter.
You could hear his disgust as he said Harry's name.
Mr. Potter can't be your son's weapon,
Lord Death told them. Their souls are incompatible.
Excuse me?
Vernon exclaimed as he glared at his nephew, knowing it was his fault. Heavy flinched when he saw the look his uncle was getting him. He knew his uncle blamed him, and that meant he was going to get it when they went home. He could only hope that it wouldn't be the cage or the collar and leash.
Come here, Harry.
Heavy did it for two reasons. One, he would be away from his uncle, and the other was because Lord Death was the boss here.
Sir?
Mr. Potter, I am removing you from this abusive family. Heavy looked at the Death Guard in shock, while Burnin turned purple in anger. You're gonna live with my son and I.
You can't do this!
Burnin yelled.
Actually, he can.
The boy said from behind the Dursleys, causing them to all turn.
The bruises and scars are a sign of abuse. From the way he looks, it is pretty obvious you don't feed him often or enough. It is all the evidence Lord Death needs to remove Harry from your care.
Harry, unlike his relatives, found this new mon to be fascinating. He had snow-white hair and had a giant screw sticking out over one side of his head. He was just as pale as his hair and he wore white clothes. His eyes were a couple shades lighter than his own and duller too. Both his skin and his clothes were covered in stitches. It made Harry wonder if there was a place on his body without them.
He mentally shook his head when he realized where his mind was going.
The Dursleys, on the other hand, were horrified. Not only was that man disfigured, but he was also taking the freak side. Petunia sneered at the man.
You don't want this freak!
Harry paled as he realized what his aunt was about to tell him.
Why wouldn't he?
The man asked as he took note of how pale the child had become.
The boys have witch!
Harry closed his eyes and braced himself for the pain that he knew would come.
So?
Lord Death asked, causing Harry to open his eyes and look at the Death Guard in pure shock.
He hasn't harmed or killed anyone on purpose.
Harry wasn't the only one in shock. The Dursleys couldn't believe what they were hearing.
Burnin was so purple he was almost black.
As a Death Guard, I am able to see the souls of the living. This young one's soul is still pure.
The three left in anger. Harry looked at the two men in the room in both confusion and fear. He had never been in this situation before and didn't know how he felt about it.
Mr. Potter, we are not going to harm you, the white-haired man said.
Why not? I'm a half-witch.
The only time we hunt witches is when they are evil,
Death explained before he carefully took the child's hand.
Now let us go get you some new clothes. Ones that actually fit you.
Compared to other stories I've read with this premise, this one is one of the more abrupt ones. As in, Harry just straight up abandons the Dursleys immediately. There isn't some type of setup. There is no, oh, why is he like this? No, they just straight up take the kid away from the Dursleys. Now from what I've read of this story, a lot of it just feels very rushed. Almost like, oh, let's spend a lot of time of Harry being with Lord Death and his family, which consists of Death the Kid and his two guns. But other than that, yeah, that's pretty much it. There are some side stories involving Snape, Voldemort, and Dumbledore, but they pretty much go nowhere because the story seems to have been abandoned. As far as I can tell, the story was last written in the summer of 2020, and while the writer seems to be active on fanfiction.net, they pretty much stopped writing about this story. And I'm really curious to see where they would have taken this story, because for the most part, it was nothing but setup in these chapters, and then the story just stops. It just leaves with Harry being with Death the Kid, and that's all, folks. We barely get to see anything from Hogwarts or Dumbledore or Snape. And like, yeah, nothing else. It's just set up of like, hey, where's Harry? And that's it. It's a bit unfortunate because I was mildly curious to see where the story would go. But it just stops. And it reminds me a lot of the Chronicles of Narnia Avenger story I read once. In which there's a setup to a story. But then it just gets squandered by just having the character be stuck in a different setting. Which is pretty much like this story, in which Harry is thrown to the world of Soul Eater, And that's it. Or if you want a more modern example, it's like Ant-Man the Wasp Quantumania. Oh, I'm sorry. Kang the Conqueror with special guest star Ant-Man. Just a Fact by Elemental Elf is available to read on fanfiction.net. Finally, by the time this podcast has come out, the NFL regular season will have wrapped up and the playoffs will kick off in just a few days. Of all the teams playing for a chance to get to the Super Bowl in Las Vegas, one team will surely not be there. The ones that used to play only a few yards away from where I'm recording this very podcast. The Chargers. It is safe to say this past season was a rough one for the team. From the mounting injuries the team had to deal with, losing Justin Herbert, to the massive blowout that led to the firing of both their head coach and general manager, the latter of whom had been with the team since their final years here in San Diego. This season could be seen as yet another wasted opportunity for the Chargers. One could compare their failings with those of Major League Baseball's Los Angeles Angels. Just like how they notably squandered Shohei Ohtani last season in a failed attempt at a postseason bid, the Chargers are wasting Justin Herbert's career just like they previously did with both Philip Rivers and Drew Brees. Both teams also try to be Los Angeles teams despite the majority of their fan bases being based in Orange County. And in the additional case for the Angels, playing in Anaheim. It was frankly hard to get excited for the Chargers. They had a handful of early wins against the Raiders in one of their so-called home games, as well as the Jets, the latter of which had a debatably worse season due to losing Aaron Rodgers after only 4 plays. The wins were annoyingly offset by close losses to the Dolphins, Titans, and Cowboys. And let's not even bring up Taylor Swift, the Chiefs. There were several moments throughout the season where I felt like I was only watching the team out of loyalty. On certain weeks, I would tune into the game and leave it on the background while I watched a much better game from literally any other team. I got to the point where I would not care that I was unable to watch their games only available on streaming services. During that horrendous Thursday night blowout against the Raiders, I barely paid attention to Amazon's free stream on Twitch. When I left the country for the holidays, I was glad their next game against the Bills was on Peacock, since it gave me a good reason to not watch it. Here in San Diego, at least one of our local sports anchors, who I will not bring up by name, gleefully enjoyed their downfall. Was it mean-spirited towards the team? Maybe, but then again, they're the bastards who left the Dear John letter before relocating. With the way I summed up the Chargers, you might be asking if this is some form of resignation from the team. If I finally chose to give up on the team once and for all and pick some other team to follow, would I move my fan loyalty to a much more popular team like the Ravens, 49ers, or Cowboys? Would it just settle for another team nearby like the Rams or the Cardinals? No! Absolutely not! Others have given up on this team. Some have become fans of the other 29 teams in the league. And some have simply moved on from football and now spend their Sundays doing something much more relaxing like laundry. Despite these lows, I will continue to root for the Chargers for the foreseeable future. Throughout the years, I have been asked by family and friends, why do I root for the Chargers? The most straightforward response I have given is that, to me, they're the closest thing to a home team. They're the nearby team and, well, the closest one to me. Mostly from all those years living over in the Imperial Valley. Nowadays, the closest one would technically be the Arizona Cardinals, but I really can't stand them. That, and I could care less about Arizona sports teams. I just know someday the Chargers will make it back to the Super Bowl.
Maybe they won't endure yet another lousy coach, regularly lose close games, and not have so many injuries. Crazier things have happened. After all, how many people expected the Texas Rangers to win the World Series, the biggest Golden Knights to raise the Stanley Cup, or the Denver Nuggets to be NBA champs? If they can be the best in their respective sports, why not the Chargers? The fan in me hopes that they can at least be better than they were last year. On the other hand, the San Diegan in me wishes they can go to hell. It's a very complicated relationship. I'll gladly enjoy the NFL playoffs, but in the meantime, my San Diego State Aztecs are on a mission to get back to the big dance. Go Aztecs! As I wrap up this season premiere, I wanted to say that I am thankful for anyone who's listened to this podcast ever since it began. From the fanfic authors who were excited to hear their stories being read in a fanfic, to the very few people who I've interviewed for this show, as well as to my family, from my parents who believe in me and making this podcast, to my brothers who really enjoy listening to me talk for over 2 hours, and I managed to find a way to condense those conversations into, well, 10 to 15 minutes. I am eager to see what happens next this year in 2024. Last year for me was full of ups and downs, but I believe this year will be a good one. Not just for me, but for all of us. To celebrate the start of a new season, the podcast has a fresh coat of paint, or to be more specific, new cover art. I am ready for what I expect to be an exciting fifth season of the Pop Culture Shuffle, full of more segments about the latest in film and TV, as well as more fan fiction. And maybe an interview or two. If everything works out, expect new episodes to come out every Monday. For now, that is all the time we have for today's season premiere. If you would like to know when the next episode comes out, remember to follow the podcast on your favorite stream provider. You can also follow me on social media at MrJoelGarcia9 on Threads, Instagram, and Twitter/X, as well as at MrJoelGarcia on TikTok. Until next time, thank you for listening.